Good evening and welcome to the Icecast. My name is Shane Chebsey, and on the Icecast we talk to comic artists, writers and publishers about their work, their lives and everything in between. And tonight on the Icecast I'm very happy to welcome Mr. Mark Jackson. Good evening, Mark. How are you doing?
Hi, Shane. I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. Can't complain, mate. Thank you very much for coming onto the Icecast. Really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
It was really nice to get your email, actually. We haven't actually had a chat or spoke since last year, probably.
Yeah, you came to. So I came to Comic Cypia, which was great. I really enjoyed it. And in fact, my whole family enjoyed it. We had a great weekend.
Great.
And then about a month later, you came to MacPow, which is the comic event I organise.
We had a great time as well. Me and Sarah came along, and yeah, it was really nice, actually. We had a really nice day, and it was helped by the fact that it was a very nice day weather-wise as well.
It was, wasn't it? Yeah, we were very lucky. Yeah, no, it was. Because things like that, as you know, kind of help, don't they?
They do. They do make a difference. I mean, if you have a bit of luck with the weather, it can really turn an event around. And it can go either way as well. I mean, I remember one event I did in Brighton. It flopped in the afternoon because everyone went to the beach because it was really sunny.
Well, that's the thing, because you kind of want, you want it to be nice, but you don't want it to be too nice.
No. So you're sort of hoping for overcast, but warm and dry.
Yeah, just not wet, but just not really, really sunny.
Yeah, you don't want them to go somewhere else.
No, yeah, that's the fine. These are the things that people don't realise when you're organising an event, that you've got to think about everything like that. It was the year before, I think, when we were fortunate enough to have another good day. Our mutual friend Lou Stringer had said it would have been nice at MacPow to have had some things, because we were inside the town hall, to have some things outside the town hall, which is a nice idea. But the trouble is, as you know, with Comic Cylopia, it's hard to plan for these things because you have to think it's probably going to be raining, even when it shouldn't be.
Yeah, you have to assume it's gonna rain. Like we did Comic Cylopia in June, which is like the dry, typically the driest month of the year, isn't it? You still assume it's going to rain. So all the outdoor stuff had to think, okay, it's got to have coverings. We've got to have some sort of shields for the rain or the wind. Or luckily, we had good weather, but you never know. You know, we had a little bit of a shower on the Sunday, I think. There was a little bit of rain, but the Saturday was boiling. You know, it was sweltering on the Saturday. So we were very lucky, you know, but it could have gone either way. It's Britain, you know.
Well, I was very lucky last year to go I don't know if you know the illustrator Mr. Hope. He was at Comic Cylopia, and he lives this kind of way. I'm in Macclesfield in Cheshire, and he lives in Buxton, and he's been the last two MacPowers, and he always likes it when I talk about my trip to California last year. I was very fortunate to go over to the NCS Fest with the Lakes Festival, and so that's in California, and we were there. Well, I was there for 5 days, but the event was the weekend, and it never rains there apart from the days we were there.
It seriously rained. I didn't know it rained.
Oh yeah. So I got there on the Wednesday night, and it had been raining, and the next morning I got up about sort of 7 o'clock and did a FaceTime with my family at home, and they just got home from school, and my wife said, she turned the thing around to show me the sunshine outside, and I turned around my phone to show that it was raining in California.
You took really the British weather with you, mate. That's what it is.
And all the locals say it never rains here. The sun did come out. It wasn't raining all the time. That would have just been atrocious.
And it's still pretty warm.
It was still warm, yeah. But for the first 2 mornings, I think it was mainly in the mornings, it was just kind of a bit wet. And you just think, I didn't sign up for this. But maybe that was my payback for leaving my family.
There you go.
And going on an adventure.
Definitely. But obviously, you're not just a con organiser. You are also an artist and a writer and a musician, I believe.
That's true.
So we have quite a few things in common.
Yes, of course. Yeah, of course.
But obviously, you've been doing predominantly. I mean, I know you as a comic artist or a cartoonist. And the first encounter I had with you, I think, as a cartoonist, was probably actually Lake's website did a little article on you, I think, if I remember correctly.
All right, okay.
And I remember learning about you, and I'd heard about your work, and you got in touch with me about Comic Salopia. But I was already aware of you then, I think, because, you know, I'd heard about the work you'd done with schools and libraries and all that sort of stuff. So,
yeah.
But how long have you actually been working in comics, Mark? When did you join the industry?
Well, so my first professional... I've been sort of saying that sort of this is my 10th year kind of coming back to comics. And what I mean by that was kind of obviously the cliche of always being interested and drawing comics since I was little.
Yeah.
I distinctly remember sort of like around, especially around sort of like 11, 12, kind of 13, making my own little A5 comics and just making a lot of comics based off of around things that were going on that inspired me, you know, whether it be Star Wars or the A-Team or things like that, you know. And so I'd then adapt them to doing, whether it be funny animal kind of characters and stuff like that. So I've always kind of done that. So when, and then kind of did it, but didn't really know how to kind of do that as a job kind of thing.
Yeah.
And obviously knowing that people did it as a job, but not really...
Not knowing how to get into it, how to break in, as it were.
Yeah, well, back then it wasn't really, it wasn't as apparent to me. And my parents, although they encouraged what I was doing, again, didn't really know how. Mm. And however, I did have, I'm looking around here, but I did, at some point, I made contact and tried to get an internship randomly at Marvel Comics in New York.
Oh, really?
And I've got it somewhere. I got a letter back detailing some things. And I think, it couldn't happen for whatever reason. So I was trying things. And the same way that the first time I ever went to a comic shop was living in Macclesfield, but was in Nostalgia and Comics.
In Birmingham?
In Nottingham.
Oh, there used to be one in Nottingham, didn't there? Yeah.
I convinced my dad, and we all went as a family, and also took a friend from school who was a comics fan, to go to this comic shop because I think it was Paul Neary from Marvel UK was going to be there with Spider-Man. Right?
The actual Spider-Man.
The actual Spider-Man. And I just thought, it just seemed like something I should be going to. And I said to my dad, we should go to this. And so we had, my dad's got family in Nottingham, so I think we tied it in with a little bit of a visit as well. So we went to the comic shop, and so it was the first time I was going to a comic shop, and I kind of met this guy and had my little A5 comics that he kind of looked at and, you know, kind of was polite, but, you know, he wasn't very encouraging.
I mean, how old were you then, Mark? How old were you?
I must have been 12, maybe 13.
Oh.
But it was a weird one because Spider-Man was there and, you know, big Spider-Man fan. But it just shows for how the way you are at that kind of age.
Yeah.
Even though I was in a comic shop, I didn't realise that I was amongst my own kind at that
point. Yeah, it took a while for it to just click. You know, all these people read comics too.
Well, yeah. And so when this guy, Paul Neary, said to me, who is Spider-Man's alter ego, secret identity, I knew it, but I pretended I didn't know because I didn't realise.
Usually you get beaten up for that, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, I don't know. And I think I was just a bit, I was young and I was just a bit kind of, you know, it was all a bit mind-blowing. But I picked some comics as well that I was buying, and I took them up to the till, and my dad was kind of there. And the guy, and one of them was an issue of Gru the Wanderer
by the
mighty Sergio Aragonés,
who
I've been fortunate enough to meet twice, which is really cool. I'm a huge fan of his work. Mm. And the guy behind the counter said to me, he said, oh, have you had the warning about this comic? So my dad's kind of thinking, what is this that he's buying? And I said, warning? No, why? And he went, oh, it's just that it's funny. And I was like, all right. And so I distinctly remember that. And so, going back to what you said, so that was kind of my I was into comics, and I was reading comics and drawing comics, and then I went to college and I did some projects on college on comics. I've still got some of those. So comics were still part of who I was, and then I kind of sort of got into graphic design and ended up working for a design company in Macclesfield, and was kind of clinging on to the cartoon drawing.
Yeah, you still brought it into your work whenever you could do sort of thing.
Whenever I could, but there wasn't really as many opportunities. The guy who ran the company saw that I was good at that and tried to encourage me and gave me opportunities when they were there.
Right, yeah.
But then I then started getting, I then suddenly had money because I was working.
Yeah.
And then going, you know, you're connecting it up then to what you mentioned about music. I then started buying a lot more of my own music. And I think at one point, music just kind of took over and going out, you know, and having an occasional drink and just having a social life.
Yeah.
And comics kind of just kind of, I never at any point remember thinking that I was too old for comics. There was never, it was never that. They just kind of drifted off for a little bit.
Well, I think, you know, now not so much, but back then, the social life and comics don't really go together, do they? I mean, a lot of comic artists will say, you know, well, I don't really have a social life because I'm at home drawing all the time. And you can have a social life, but it tends to be with other comics people.
Well, that's what I've discovered sort of since then, you know, doing events that, you know, the events are obviously a great way to engage with people who might be interested in your work. And if you're very lucky, people who know your work and have come to have a chat with you. But it's also a chance to connect with fellow creators and build that network, because that's kind of invaluable for me. And I kind of found, I kind of knew what was going on in comics. You know, every now and then I'd know, like, I remember suddenly discovering that Frank Miller had done a sequel to The Dark Knight Returns.
Oh, yeah.
and then I didn't get it at the time, but bought it, I don't know, maybe 10 years later.
Is it that old? Oh, God.
Yeah. And kind of wished that he hadn't done a sequel to The Dark Knight Returns.
It wasn't great, was it? It wasn't great.
I kind of look at it, and it's funny because I look at it and I think, well, if only this wasn't coloured, maybe it would be better if there was no colour on it. Because I think it's Lynn Varley who coloured it as well.
Yeah, same colourist. Yeah.
But she, I don't know, she was doing a whole different kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it was maybe it was experimenting, you know, with different types of colouring. I mean, it's a totally different colouring process than what was done in the 80s with the first book.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest things that I noticed now, you know, when you look at these things afterwards, obviously Klaus Janson wasn't inking it, so that changed. And Frank Miller's work is different.
Yeah, it's changed. He's gone more into the direction of cartooning, hasn't he?
Well, it's funny because that's what it is. Because it's very cartoony, and so I do like it for that, obviously. And I like the fact that he just does whatever he wants and he doesn't really care.
Yeah.
What anybody thinks.
And you have to respect that, don't you? You know, for an artist, you know, he doesn't bow to public opinion. He just does his thing, you know.
I think there will always be something about his stuff that's got a very graphic kind of style to it.
Yeah.
And I don't think that'll ever go away. You know, obviously I love his use of solid black and just that the minimal kind of style.
Yeah.
I doubt anybody can even tell, but I am influenced by his stuff.
That's interesting.
Yeah, his work does influence my work, but I find that an interesting thing with any kind of cartoon is that you might be surprised as to what influences them, because what you do, and it's the same with music, isn't it?
Yeah,
that you might take things in as an inspiration, but how they then come back out. It's only you that recognises where the inspiration came from.
Yeah, it goes through a filter, doesn't it? Like with art and music, you draw it in and then it filters out through everything else that is you. And so people will say, you know, like with the music, you probably get it as well. And I know I get it. People say, well, what are your influences? And when I tell them, they're like, well, I can't hear that at all in your music. It's like, well, that's fine. You know, I'm glad, really, because if you wear it on your sleeve and it's really obvious, it's a bit... It's just derivative, isn't it?
You know. No, definitely. I think, I just kind of, when I kind of came back to it, like I say, 10 years ago, I'd started doing, so at that point I'd been working as a graphic designer for 15 years.
Yeah. So what was it that inspired you to get back into comics then, Mark?
Well, just, what was it? It was just, there'd be always something that I would see, and more often than not, I'd maybe watch something, and that would spark something in terms of a story, and I'd start thinking about a story. Right. I remember watching Heroes, that show,
yeah.
and I used to come out of each episode, and I'm talking about the first series because it kind of went a bit wrong, didn't it?
Heroes? It did, but the first series was pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember just coming out of watching it. And my mind was going, and I thought, right, okay, so I still have that in me, you know, to sort of want to create stuff. And then I just started to, I read about Kick-Ass, on a website called Ain't It Cool News.
Oh yeah, I used to be a frequent visitor. Yeah,
and they were talking about the film of this comic, and then I obviously the name just kind of stood out to me, so I clicked on the article. And then saw that John Romita Jr. was the cartoonist on the comic.
Yeah.
And I'm a huge fan of his work, and from you know, like the 80s, that, you know, I bought loads of comics with his stuff.
Yeah.
And so that then led me to then the next time I was in, I think I was working in Manchester, freelancing in Manchester, an advertising agency. And so on my lunch hour, I would go into the two comic shops that were in Manchester, Travelling Man, and there's a Forbidden Planet,
yeah.
And I think it was in Forbidden Planet that I found the first issue of Kick-Ass, and started to sort of, and thought, oh, right, okay, but I didn't buy it because I didn't have money that I felt that I could spend on comics, because comics suddenly were expensive as well.
Yeah, well, they were a lot more expensive if you'd had a 10-year gap or 20-year gap.
Yeah. Yeah, more than that. I think the last time I kind of stopped buying them, the single issues, right, 1993, around then.
Right. They were still under a pound then, weren't they?
Yeah, so they were still on newsprint. Some of the paper stocks were changing a little bit.
Yeah.
So suddenly I then come back to comics, and everything's on glossy paper.
Yeah. About three times as much.
Oh, yeah, and the colouring, that was a big thing. I struggled with the colouring because everything was being airbrushed. I'm a big fan of flat colours.
Me too. Yeah, I'm a flat colour.
And so I didn't feel like it was a world that I could associate with. But I like Kick-Ass, and I bought the trade paperback of that and really enjoyed it. And then started to go and pick up like trade paperbacks. So I did a lot of that. I'm just looking around now. You'll be able to hear. You can't hear me looking around.
This is what the bookshelf part of the episode.
I was just started buying predominantly Marvel collections of things that John Romita Jr. had been doing.
Right.
So I thought,
we've done a lot, haven't we?
Yeah, I feel comfortable with this. I can come back into comics now with this guy that's still working, and I like his stuff. Yeah, it's coloured differently, but Dean White was the big guy at Marvel. He was colouring everything, and so I quite liked his stuff. And then buying them then got me into doing them, and then I started doing like a web comic, which was kind of like a vector illustrator kind of thing.
Right.
I just had an idea for a kind of a story called Man from Space, and so I was kind of still making comics. I started making comics again, but this time more like a graphic designer. So it was a means to an end, really. I did these little fuzzy felt kind of characters that I would copy and paste, and it was quite crude, but it got me back into the mindset.
Yeah, it got you into the idea of telling stories through comics, and it doesn't really matter how crude it is, does it? If it's just a starting point, isn't it?
Yeah, no, definitely. And then from that, I then decided to turn that then into a print comic, and then 8 years ago, we moved back to Macclesfield, and I remember distinctly thinking, I was just in the zone there where I thought, I feel like this is something that I need to try and push.
Yeah.
And to go somewhere, and I just started doing various different comics, different little strips, and I'd contacted David Lloyd at Aces Weekly.
Right.
They were just launching Aces Weekly. I'd seen Lou, mention Aces Weekly on his site. He was doing a combat call-in for it. Yeah. So because he was doing a combat call-in, which is, oh, here we go. This is how it connects back. So because he was doing a combat call-in, I thought, oh, right, the kind of style that I have might be something that they might be interested in.
Yeah.
The same way as when I went and met the Marvel editor back in the 80s at Nostalgia and Comics, I was more interested in talking to him about Lou's work in the Transformers and Action Force comics, because again, I could associate more with Lou's style than I could do with like the mighty the Jeff Senior, whose work I loved in those comics. But obviously his style wasn't the style that I was drawing like. Lou's was more similar. Mm. The same way that Sergio Aragonés, you know, I'm not comparing myself to him, but his style was a cartoony style.
Yeah.
And that's, so with Aces Weekly, so I approached David Lloyd and said that I'm doing some stuff, and I sent him a few things, and he was polite. But then eventually it got to the point where he said to me, he said, I think you know that what you're doing isn't good enough yet.
Oh, fair play. Yeah.
So at the moment, I'm just quite busy with getting this going, but come back to me, you know, keep in touch. And little did he know that I was going to do that. So I kind of went off and I found that...
you didn't let that sort of knock you then? You just thought, okay, I'll take that on board. I'll keep going. I'll keep improving until I am ready.
I had to think to myself, well, either I listen to him and he's been in the comics business for a long time, or I go, what does David Lloyd know? Yeah. And probably not be talking to you now.
Yeah.
Because I listened and I did know what he meant, and he was very polite about it, but I did look at, because I was kind of showing him for him to tell me what I needed to do to make it so it would get in Aces Week.
Yeah, yeah.
And he couldn't do that. He needed me to know and me to figure that out. And so I went off and just did a lot, started doing more stuff. That was, the stuff I was showing him, I was doing by hand. And then I started just doing more stuff by hand on the computer in a different kind of way, not vector, but more pen and ink style.
Digitally,
Still doing it in a different way. I was using the mouse to draw and stuff like that.
So
I kind of straddled with graphic designer, but cartoonist. And then when things really clicked, when I stopped making comics like a graphic designer and started making them like a cartoonist.
Yeah.
And suddenly I started thinking about different ideas. And rather than just doing one thing, I had been caught with the Man from Space thing for quite a while.
Yeah.
And suddenly I thought, right, try something different. And so I did a couple of little strips, and I discovered that we had a free newspaper in Macclesfield that had just started. It seemed very focused on the arts, which was quite interesting for me.
That's good.
For a local paper, there's a lot of stuff in here.
That's unusual.
And what I discovered was that the editor owned an art gallery, and it was the art gallery that I would walk past every day.
Small town, eh?
Yeah, and he ran the paper from the art gallery space and ran the paper from that desk. So I just said to him, you know, I'm a cartoonist. I've got this comic that I'm doing online. Would you be interested? So he ran a piece about it, which was really nice of him to do. And then I just said, listen, would you be interested in having a comic strip in the newspaper? And newspapers don't commission new comics ever.
It doesn't happen anymore, does it? No.
Well, especially local ones as well. Anyway, he said, all right. He said, let's do it. He said, I can only pay you £5 a comic. he said, I know that's really bad. He said, but if you want to do it, I will pay you that, and your comic can go in the paper.
Yeah.
And it came out twice a month, so I was doing two comic strips a month. And what that did was give me the even though it's only two a month, but it gave me the regular work ethic of writing, illustrating, and getting a comic to a publication to get it out there for print.
Yeah.
And that, I would say to anybody who is self-publishing, is really, really important to give yourself, if you've got a deadline, that's better, but give yourself a fake deadline.
Yeah.
Aim towards, and obviously this is in the good old age, but aim towards a comic event that you want to take your comic to and stuff like that. So I was doing that regularly. And so then what that gave me was a chunk of comic strips to then go back to David Lloyd a year later and go, hey, David, I don't know if you remember me, but I contacted you, and here's what I've been doing this past year.
Oh, no, it's him again.
Yeah. and to be fair to him, he came back to me really quickly, and he really liked them. He said, "This is terrific," and he could see that I had listened to
worked. It. Yeah, he'd worked on it, like.
Yeah, and he and next thing you know, he said, "Yeah, I'd like to do something." So I started doing something in Aces Weekly. I did
Goons of the Galaxy, was it?
No, the first thing I did for Aces Weekly was called Duckless.
Oh yeah,
about this little duck who drew drew comics. And then the comics he made were kind of came to life,
yeah.
Or kind of were part of reality. And I did I had two runs in Aces Weekly with that character, and then I started doing Goons of the Galaxy, and I did four series of four installments of that comic.
Yeah.
And then around somewhere in and amongst that time, I've been emailing stuff for maybe 2-3 years. To the Beano, again, Lou, lovable Lou Stringer.
Oh, what a great man. The great legend himself.
You've got to give him his Marvel title, lovable Lou Stringer.
Yeah.
and Lou had very kindly had sent me an email address for an editor who was actually the Dandy at the time.
Mm.
But I think I heard back, and it was a no.
Hmm.
And then, but what it did, it got me on a mailing list, and every 6 months, this editor, Michelle O'Donnell, got to give
hello,
it would send out an email asking for cartoonists, what new ideas have you got?
Hmm.
And I kept getting this email and thinking, all right, okay. and I sent a couple of things and heard nothing.
Hmm.
And then this one time I sent over all the comic strips that I'd done for the newspaper, and then this one comic with a character called Lenny the Lettuce, and off it went. And
the rest is history, almost.
Well, 2 weeks later, at the time when I thought, oh, I don't think I'm ever going to hear back from the Beano again, suddenly I got an email saying it's no to everything else, but it's yes to Lenny the Lettuce.
What was it about Lenny the Lettuce that they loved so much? Because it sounds like you submitted a lot of different stuff. Did you ever find out what it was that made them say yes?
Well, what's not to love about a talking lettuce?
Well, there is that.
You know, it writes itself, doesn't it, really?
It does.
And I think, I don't know, it was goofy, I think. And
yeah.
I think Michelle was the assistant editor, I think, I don't want to do a disservice, to John Anderson.
Ah, right, who's now the Beano editor, isn't he?
Yeah, and I think John liked my stuff. I think he liked it. I think he thought it was kind of different and the tone was just a little bit abstract.
Yeah.
And I think he just thought it was a bit offbeat, and I think he kind of liked it. So I think I've got a lot to thank John for as well for that. And so, I got suddenly one minute I'm in the local paper and next minute I'm in the Beano, and it just blew my mind. Because
it's a massive leap, isn't it?
It was because I obviously, if you said to me, well, would you have liked to have been in the Beano?
Hmm.
I would say yes to that question. But then would you say, do you think you actually will get in the Beano? I'd probably have said no, because you think, well, how am I going to get in the Beano? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's the pinnacle of British humour comics, isn't it?
I mean, the history
of that book, it's just, you know, that you can't really put any other existing comic above the Beano, can you?
No, for a cartoonist, it's like just, and it's done me no harm being in the Beano. people's, and it's a great, even though, you know, you never say never, but I don't know whether at the moment there's room for me in the Beano. I think the way that the Beano is. It commissions stuff. Beano Studios is a lot bigger,
yeah.
And I think there's a bit more of a house kind of style. And I think my stuff perhaps just isn't the right kind of thing for the Beano.
It was really exciting for a while, actually, in the Beano when they were doing all that different stuff. When Gary Northfield was in there and people like that and Hunter. Yeah. It was like, wow, the Beano's just, it doesn't look the same anymore. It's got all these cool styles. And I was really, I actually picked it up a few times. I haven't bought the Beano since I was a kid, you know. But when all those interesting cartoonists were appearing in there, it made me pick it up. you know. Well, and I think it's leveled out a little bit again now, unfortunately.
I think the tone, you know, the tone is kind of consistent. And I think the thing is that I think is important is what you're just saying, which I think is the way that we probably grew up with the comics that we saw, is that it visually, you and this is going back to me saying about seeing Lou's stuff in the pages of Transformers. When I looked at the main Transformer comic, I loved it.
Yeah.
But I didn't have a connection with that in terms of how I would draw, but I did with Lou's stuff.
Yeah.
And that's why I think, as particularly children's comics, it's important for every comic to perhaps look quite different.
Yeah, to have its own identity. Yeah,
and particularly because you want the children who are picking it up to go, well, I don't draw like that, but I think I draw like that.
Yeah.
And because then they can see how they could be in that comic.
That's
it. And I think that's really important. And I think if you make it look too house style, you might not get a generation of children who are buying it and also trying to get in it.
Yeah, because that's a big thing about comics, isn't it? I mean, how many comics readers also have aspirations to draw comics? I would say a huge percentage. It's one of those mediums that, you know, people feel that they can be part of that thing.
Yeah,
you know,
I think that's really important to pick it up and turn the page and find the comic in there that makes you want to make a comic.
Yeah,
that's a whole part of comics, and I think that's why it is important to have that those different styles, very distinct different styles. And so I think I got in there just at the right time. I have done other stuff for them. Yeah. Last year I did some stuff for an online, because they do a lot of online games.
Yeah.
And they approached me to do that, and I got a chance to draw lots of different versions in my style of Nasher, which was really cool.
Right. Yeah, because your Nasher is different to the other Nashers, I'll say that.
So that was just really cool, because you just think, because you part of you wants to say to them, but you know not to, isn't there anybody else who should be doing this? Because how come I'm doing this, you know? Because you do feel, and I think you always have the imposter syndrome.
Yeah,
mine has calmed down a little bit, because I would go to the comic events and sit there, and it was only... There's people like Sean Phillips who would say to me, look at me, name drop.
He's a good lad. He's a good lad.
He is. Sean's been great. He's been really encouraging for my work.
Yeah.
And to me, Sean's the kind of person who I would think wouldn't not have time for me. But you know, he's got more than enough time for me, which is really surprising. It was really nice to see that he was.
Yeah.
And he said really nice things about my work. And
cool.
And I suppose, again, the imposter syndrome comes because you think, well, why would Sean Phillips be saying nice things about my work?
And it is hard to take it on board, isn't it? When someone you admire, for example, you know, compliments you, it's like, well, this doesn't make any sense to me.
And as he knows, it means the world, you know, when somebody does that, because it just helps kind of validate you. And it sunk in really when I was at the Lakes Festival, the second or third year, when I realised that all the other creators who were there didn't look at me and go, why is Mark Jackson here? They just thought I was there for the same reasons they were.
Yeah, you're just one of the gang, as it were.
Being part of the comics scene, and that's when I, you know, you kind of think, okay, calm down, and then that then gives you more encouragement to do it.
Yeah, and confidence as well. It's having that confidence.
It's. I say this a lot when I do. You know, you mentioned that I do the drawing stuff with children in libraries and schools, and you know, obviously in the good old days. And I always say it's not about skill; it's about confidence. It's about doing it. If you can pick the pen up and you've got an idea for something, it doesn't matter how it looks. It's just about just wanting to do it.
Yeah, the confidence to do it, and the ability to listen to advice and to learn about storytelling and all that sort of stuff. Because if you can tell a story, you don't have to be that great an illustrator or draftsman. Do you?
No, with comics, it's all about how to convey the story.
Yeah, yeah.
And if people can follow it, doesn't matter, you know, the polishing it and making it look. I think once you're happy with how it looks, then that's as much as you can do.
Yeah.
And so you've got to get to the point where you think, I'm happy with that. You're always going to look at your stuff and pick away at it a little bit.
Of course you are. Of course you are. I think every single artist I've had on here has said, you know, they hate their own work after they've finished it. You know, I think that's a common thing for all artists.
I do a lot. I'm fortunate enough because I've got, you know, people in my hometown here kind of know my stuff. And I've been fortunate enough to do things for a number of local businesses. So my work, you know, from time to time can be seen around Macclesfield, which is really nice.
Yeah, I saw it myself actually when I came to Macclesfield to, you know, for the festival. I saw your work in windows, shop windows.
Yeah, no, I did a lot. I did all the windows. Yeah,
it was great.
As many windows as people would let me do.
Yeah.
But what I do, so when I'm doing like a finished thing, so I give you an idea, example, I'd done some stuff for a local cafe here in Macclesfield that after the, I did some stuff for them last year at Christmas, like a promotion for Christmas offers, and they're called Velo, they're a bicycle kind of themed cafe. So I had Father Christmas with a sack full of mince pies riding a bicycle. When they were reopening after the lockdown, they were struggling to come back, so that they didn't reopen until September. But they wanted me to do some drawings for some A-boards that they were going to put outside.
Right.
And one of my guilty pleasures is after I'd drop my girls off at school, I would walk back through Macclesfield and I'd treat myself to a cheeky coffee, Shane, outside fellow, just sat there with my little coffee and just watching Macclesfield go past.
Yeah.
And whenever I've done work for them, I have to sit there staring at my own artwork. And all I do is go, is try not to find the thing that leaps out at me. Why did I draw it like that?
Oh, yeah. It's painful, isn't it? When it's on public display.
Because the public aren't going to notice. They just think they either like it or they don't.
Oh, yeah. They think it's
great.
They're
not going to look at it with any kind of close, kind of, you know, put it under the microscope or anything.
No.
That's for me to do, to look at why did I not notice that before it went to print?
That's it. We can usually with public work that we put out, you know, say it's in a book or something like that, you can just forget about it, can't you? You just move on, you know. But when it's in the street there as a reminder, it's a bit different. You have to sort of...
Well, it's funny because I definitely have two ways of thinking when I'm doing stuff. So when I'm doing stuff like that I know I'm not going to escape, I become a bit more obsessed by it. I've been fortunate enough to, over the past sort of 4 years, 5 years, maybe even longer, get some regular comic work, primarily comic strips. So I do a lot of comic strips. For the past sort of couple of years, I did a comic in Comic Scene magazine.
Oh, right, yeah.
Right from the very start, I've so I did that. a page a month in that. And again, that goes back to the whole deadline kind of thing. I would always work, so I was doing one a month and I had to have it, you know, so there was a certain date was my deadline, but I would very rarely be working on it any further away from it than like a week. I would always go, well, when's it needed? And I would know how long it would take me to do, and I would work on it two days prior to the deadline.
Yeah.
So because I think it was my way of also capturing the spirit of comics, rather than going, oh, I did that weeks ago, months ago. You know, it's let me draw this now with how I'm feeling now in mind.
Yeah.
And by doing it that way, you build up a sense of it's okay, it's done, send it.
Yeah. You're not going to sort of procrastinate over every detail.
Yeah,
because that's deadly, isn't it? Because you could—that's dangerous. That is, if you start procrastinating over stuff,
you can stare at it,
second guessing
constantly, and find things you want to change. And I did that with. So I've been doing a lot of comic strip work, whether it be for publications or I started in lockdown. I did a weekly Instagram comic called Bring the Ninja, which was like a little 4-panel strip that you swipe across, and that was me because I was losing work because of publications ceasing to be or ceasing to publish for the time being. But I thought, no, I've built all this up now. I can't now stop making comics.
You've got to keep producing, haven't you? Just because the work's drying up, you can't stop producing.
My brain was like, And so I started doing that, and then I started at the start of the year. I'd done this Magnum PI comic, this little mini comic that I put out at the start of the year, which who knew that making a comic about Magnum PI would actually become one of my favourite things to do. But it is, and somehow it was really well received as well, yeah. And became my best selling self published comic.
Oh really? Wow.
And again, that was encouraged by Sean late last year.
Really?
He encouraged me to do it. So I did that at the start of the year, and then started doing a monthly Magnum comic online.
Yeah.
That was on this website called Ko-fi. You can buy people like a cyber coffee.
Oh, yes. Yeah, familiar.
So it's like a buy me a coffee thing. It's like a way of supporting people's work.
Yeah.
So I thought, right, I'm going to start doing that. I'd lost my comic scene job, and I needed to fill that gap of what I was earning there. And I thought, right, the Magnum comic was really popular. Let's see if anybody'd be interested in that. And I said, right, I'll do the first one, and then I'll see if I can then fund it each month to replace the money I lost. And I managed to do that, which was really cool.
That's impressive, mate. That's really impressive to do that. It's not easy, is it, making a regular income from your own stuff, you know, a regular reliable income. You know, usually when you're doing your own stuff, it's up and down. If you can,
I've been very fortunate because I do a lot of self-publishing, so I've got a nice chunk of a body of work, like a back catalog that I've got in my store, and fortunately, because everything didn't close, people could still order stuff and I could still get to the post office and send it to them. And then, so I'd done the Magnum comic at the start of the year, so I'd got something new as well. So kind of going into the lockdown still with something new.
Yeah.
And then when I was doing the Ninja comic, I thought, I'm doing this and this is free. And then my brain kicks in, and the self-publisher brain thinks, all right, how many of these do I need to do to get me a decent enough page count that I can then turn into a printed comic and then get, and so that's, so I put that out in a print version in July.
Right.
So somehow I've managed to self-publish two short comics.
It's a really good way of building it up, you know, releasing it free on the internet in little segments and then collecting it into a comic. You know, it's a really good way of doing it because it keeps you working and also means that you're working towards something that you can then hopefully get some income from as well.
This is, and I have to think of it that way. I have a young family, and I can't. Yeah. For me, making comics is a pleasure, but it can't just be something I'm doing as a hobby.
No,
my time is precious.
Yeah,
and I've got to prove to my family that it's worth me doing this. And I in the early days when I kind of went back to it, you know, my wife quite rightly was sort of going, you know, have we really got time for you to be doing this? We've got the work.
Yeah.
We've got a business. Me and my wife have a graphic design business. We've got that. Right. We've got a young daughter. And I had to kind of prove, and I didn't know. You know, I knew I wanted to do it. I knew that I had desire to do it. And I thought, there's got to be something here. There's got to be, it can't just be something I'm messing around with. I think this could go somewhere.
You had a self-belief, basically, then, inside. You had a real belief that it would work.
I did, and I didn't know whether that was right or not.
Well, you're going to doubt, even though you believe in yourself, there's always going to be those moments of doubt, isn't there?
Because you do, and you know, most married men have to hold their hands up and go, my wife is right. you know, and even my wife will say, well, maybe I was wrong on this occasion. It did work, but, you know, you just don't know. And that's self-publishing anyway. You've got to believe in what you're doing, and you've got to just give it a go. If you think the idea is good, do as best job as you can. And
you've got to go all in, haven't you? I think in my experience with self-publishing, you've got to go all in and you've got to give it your very best and be willing to work, you know, incredible hours sometimes.
I mean, I've been quite lucky because when I came back to comics, and again, this is why my wife was like, really? Is this what we're really doing now? Because literally I came back to it 10 years ago when our daughter was, so we literally got a newborn baby.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so it probably wasn't the right time.
Well, the initial response to having it, I remember when my son was born, it was like, I'm just going to give up all that stuff now. I'm going to go and get a job.
So, I wasn't, but what I, yeah, it was kind of like that kind of belief and just and just thinking that there's something in this and just wanting to create something. And I think I've kind of lost my train of thought because I had a good anecdote there, and I've lost it.
It's escaped you.
It was the connecting to the sort of like the 10 years of doing this and just realizing that it is about sort of hard work and putting it in there and. Oh, that was it. It's back. It's back. I knew I'd get it. So, baby, when you work for yourself and you work from home, which I've done for a long time, and then you throw a child into the mix, suddenly, and that child doesn't go to nursery. That child stays with you until pretty much they go to preschool and then school. So I think we both work with children in the house for 8 years.
Yeah.
Right. What you realise is that it's amazing what you can do in a very short space of time. So I didn't really do a lot of working like all hours. I just found gaps and slotted comics in there and did it that way. Because when it came time to go to bed, it was time to go to bed. It wasn't time to then start making comics. So I was probably... At one point, doing comics when I perhaps shouldn't have been, you know? But I thought no, if I can just do this,
I can do some comics. They've just gone.
I think I can prove that it's worth, you know, our family's investment, so to speak. Because obviously, when you self-publish, the print costs are you.
It's everything. Everything's on you. Yeah, it's hard, isn't it?
And I never did big numbers. I always did small numbers. So, which was great because you can sell out by selling 25 copies. Like, sold out, and which is great. And I've always kept the numbers low. I probably the past year just upped them a little bit, but I never do like hundreds of copies.
No,
I just test it out. And the great thing with digital print. There is a difference the more copies you have printed.
Oh yeah,
but the difference mainly will be there in terms of what your profit will be. As long as you are covering your print and making something, which I always do, even when I do small short print.
As long as you're making some profit. Yeah. And the thing is, if you can, once you get used to how many you're going to sell, like if you know that, okay, I know I'm going to sell. Like, I don't know, 50 copies when I launch this new book, then you print 50 and you're not going to have any left over. So even if it's, out of that 50 copies, you're only making 50 quid, for example, you've got 50 quid. And it's like a controllable, measurable amount of profit. Yeah. And then I assume you just build up the back catalogue and gradually build up the income that way.
Well, that's what I've got, if you were to go on my website, I've got a nice sort of back catalogue of comics that different styles in terms of different genres and different characters. They're all kind of humour comics, and so I've built that up.
Yeah,
which has been really cool, and it's nice for me to kind of dip in and out. And what I've found now is that I've kind of veered away a little bit from setting out to do. I am making a comic book. I'm now. I think for the foreseeable future, I am just focusing on doing comic strips that will then be collected because I found that my brain was struggling, especially during lockdown, to focus on anything that was long form.
Yeah, yeah.
Even the Magnum comic, which was, it's just a 12-page mini comic, but it was two panels a page. I kind of saw that in my brain as if you lay out all those panels, it's just one long comic strip.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't a comic book; it was a comic strip.
So you were able to conceive the whole story in your head, basically, even though it was a bit longer.
It had a start. It had the setup. It had the thing going on in the middle, and then it had the gag at the end.
Yeah,
So it was a comic strip. And that's how I did it, and that's and so like Bring the Ninja, that comic book is made up of comic strips, and so everything I'm kind of doing now moving forward is doing the comic strips, and I just started doing launched last week this new Spook Kids comic.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about that because obviously you sent me a very kindly sent me a PDF of it, which I enjoyed. Yes.
Wow, thank you.
So, what? How did that come about? I mean, those characters are—they all seem like people you might have met, or at least to be inspired by people you might have met. They seem quite. Even though it's a short strip, you get quite a good impression of who those characters are.
Right. Well, that's nice. I came up with those characters. It was 2018, so 2 years ago, and I'd watched. And I'm proud to say I watched the Ghostbusters reboot with the female cast.
Oh, right, yeah.
And I'm proud to say that I enjoyed it.
Hey, someone has to, don't they? You know?
I didn't know what the problem was. I thought these girls are funny. This is I liked it. Mm. And I came out of that after watching it with the idea of, I don't know, maybe I was in my Charlie Brown Peanuts kind of phase. We watch a lot of that at home.
Oh, and, great stuff.
Yeah, and I thought, okay, kids, Ghostbusters, but with kids. That was my premise.
Right, go.
So I drew these three little characters, two guys and a girl, and the names that I had then are still the names now. So
really?
Yeah, so there was Eric, who's going to be like the scientist kind of guy, and then there was Nelly, who was the girl who's got kind of like a sort of blue kind of hair, and then Bud, who I kind of saw as a bit of a like a Bill Murray. Well, like Bill Murray.
Bit of a goof.
He was more of a Shaggy, I suppose, from Scooby Doo.
Yeah.
Whereas Nelly, the girl, she was more like your Peter Venkman, Bill Murray. Yeah. Kind of smart, kind of one-liners kind of thing, and a little bit sarcastic, and a little bit like Calvin from Calvin and Hobbes.
Ah, right. Another great comic strip.
Oh. My favourite comic strip of all time.
Amazing.
And so I kind of had this idea of that, the kids Ghostbusters, and then somewhere around that time, I kind of relatched onto Paper Girls, the Image comic.
Yeah, great book.
Which I remember coming out at the time and never bought it.
Right. You just sort of...
And then I had a friend...
I have to read that. That looks good, do you know?
Yeah, I remember seeing the cover and thinking, wow, this the front cover of the first issue was just like this bright sort of... bright yellow with the magenta. And it was just like, what is this? This is really cool. But didn't buy it for whatever reason. And then my friend here in Macclesfield, who I know as Comics Andrew... He buys a lot of comics. He's got a proper job, so he's got a bit more money.
He could afford to buy a lot of comics.
Yeah, so he buys a lot of comics. And I sent him a message saying, oh, did you ever read Paper Girls? He said, I did. I said, I've got the first 25 issues. I'm up to the, you know, the what's come out so far. He said, would you like to borrow them?
Oh.
So he lent me the whole set, and I read them over Christmas 2018. Oh,
fantastic.
And that got me thinking about doing something with the Spook Kids kind of idea.
Yeah.
With that. And so that started influencing me. And then Stranger Things was influencing me.
Right.
And then to fast forward to this time last year, I launched what I planned to be a 4-issue series of those characters at Thought Bubble.
Yeah.
And that was my plan, was to launch it at Thought Bubble and then come back this year to Thought Bubble with the collected edition of all 4 issues.
But of course this year.
Well, this year that happened. Yeah. But then also at the start of the year, I don't know what it was. The first issue, it is, you know, it is a good comic. I have done an all right job. It's not, you know, there's nothing wrong with the comic book. But when I look at it, I can pick more holes in it than I have done with anything else I've done
recently
or over the past 5 years.
Ah.
And I think it's because I was trying to do something different with it.
Yeah. It was an experiment in the way that
I was trying to do a series and I'd kind of forgotten really about, I hadn't put into it what I usually put into my comics. And I felt when I looked at it afterwards, it was missing that. And so during lockdown, I was thinking about this and I thought, I just don't think I'm going to even though I'd promised everybody, including Comics Andrew and his son, no, don't worry, this one, because I've done a couple of other things in the past where I've never carried it on. But I said, don't worry, this one I will definitely finish. And I'm sat there and I thought, I'm too far away from it. I don't think where I was going with this, I want to do that anymore.
And that's interesting. So you've sort of lost your sort of enthusiasm for it before you finished it, and then found it hard to complete.
I couldn't. Everything. There were so many things in it. I thought, I don't know where I was going with that, and it just didn't. It didn't come across the way I thought it was going to do.
Yeah.
And it didn't really fit in with the other comics that I'd done. Mm. And some would say, well, that's good. It doesn't have to. But it does, from my point of view, in order for me to want to do more of it.
Yeah. Well, you have to get some sort of satisfaction out of the work that you produce, don't you?
Yeah.
Otherwise, it just becomes a labour, a real labour, you know.
I kind of did. It was a weird one because I definitely didn't rush to get it done. You know, I can get things done quite quickly. But I did, after Christmas, I went back to it before I did a second print run. I sold lots of copies of it at Thought Bubble. It was great.
Well, that's good.
So I did a second print run. And when I did that, I did a slightly different version of it. I went back and fixed a lot of things that I didn't like about it that seemed to jump out at me. And I thought, I don't know why I did that. And I did the colour palette slightly different and gave it a bit more of a style. But I do think that I was trying to do something more. The style over substance was definitely taking over.
Right.
So fast track now. I keep going back to the Ninja comic, but that one really kind of, I was doing that weekly and loving putting that out weekly. Yeah.
And it was flowing, I think, it came easy.
Oh, it really did. And I think it's some of my best cartooning that I've ever done. I think it's, the energy.
Is that still available on your Instagram, is it, Mark?
Still available. And I'm going to hold this up to the camera so you can see. It's still available, and it still has a quote from Bill Sienkiewicz on the back.
Hey! Let's have a look what it says. Is this the big letter? Yeah. Bring the Ninja is a mashup between Rocky and Bullwinkle, Chop Socky Cinema, and reading the back of a cereal box. It's an all-out surreal, zany, and hilarious hoot. You can't not get sucked into loving Bill Sienkiewicz. Wow.
You know, and the fact that he even read it was really cool, that he replied to my email, and then he gave me that quote, and he's been really cool, because whenever I've kind of promoted it and I've thanked him on Twitter for that quote, he's done like a retweet and then said some really cool things.
Yeah.
And
I got nice sales chat
from that. Oh, it was amazing.
Yeah.
But doing that comic, I thought, right, I need to go back to this Spoo Kids idea and fix all the things that were bugging
get
me.
Get it right. You're not going to do a George Lucas, are you, and just keep twiddling with it into infinity?
I can't become George Lucas.
Don't do that, because you'll waste all your life trying to fix something.
That was the thing. And so I kind of stripped all the things away from it and just kept the elements. So the characters, I thought, the three characters, they're still cool.
Yeah.
And then I got some other little elements that I was going to, that I think at Shane I was going to drag out over four issues. and instead, the comic strip that I sent you, that I started last week online, basically, that comic strip covers in 10 panels... Mm. The first issue of the original comic.
Wow, that's some compressed storytelling there, isn't it? Eh?
And packed all the cool little highlights plus more into 10 panels.
Well, that explains why there's so much in it. That explains why you were able to recognise so much about the characters just from that one page, you know, because it was all there. All of those things, all those defining little quirks. They were all built into the, you know, all the important stuff, basically. You'd filtered.
I think the first issue I did wasn't a waste of time.
No.
And anybody who bought it hasn't wasted their money. That issue helped me figure out exactly what those characters were. And it's probably given them a bit more meat, even though in a comic strip, they don't have to have a lot of meat to the bones. They can be quite two-dimensional. But I think they feel there's a bit of a warmth to the characters, which I wanted to have.
Yeah.
And I think because I've lived with these characters for 2 years, and finally, and I'm really really pleased with this comic strip. Mm. And I've got lots of, and the cool thing is, and again, he keeps going back to this blinking ninja comic, but the great thing about the ninja comic was I really look forward to doing it each week.
Yeah, that's important.
And I'd got this cast of characters that I'd drawn, just scribbled out, and I thought, oh, all right, in five episodes' time, I'm going to get to draw this character. Oh, now I'm going to put this character into it. And it's the same thing with the new one. I've got this really fun, weird kind of cast of characters that I'm really looking forward to dropping into each of the strips each month.
Cool.
Including the ghost of Bea Arthur from The Golden Girls. Well, actually, to make it exact, the future ghost, because if you notice at the start, it's set in 1985.
Oh, when still alive. Yeah, yeah.
So it's the future ghost of Bea Arthur.
So the ghost who's travelled back in time.
She visits one of the characters in a bit of an Obi-Wan Kenobi kind of style.
Right.
And drop some knowledge on as to what needs to happen next. So,
and where can people read these comics, Mark? Where can they read them?
So if you go to my Ko-fi page, so it's ko-fi.com, Mark Makes Comics, Mark with a C, M-A-R-C. You can check them out there. You can either, some of them are where you just are very generous and let me have a coffee.
Yeah.
And you can have access to the Magnum comic and things like that. And then the spookiest one, I'm trying a thing where you've got to subscribe monthly. So it's £3 a month. And you get access to everything else, but you can only read it if you are a monthly subscriber.
Oh, right. And you get a new comic, you get a new strip each month, as well as all the other stuff.
You get that each month. So that's exclusive to that. Mm. You get that each month and all access to all the other stuff. Whether that will work, I don't know, but I'm going to try that for the time being and see. So,
it's worth a stab, isn't it? You know, and anyone listening, go on there, give it a try,
give it a go.
Yeah, it sounds great, mate. I'll have a look myself. And thanks for sending us the Spook Kids. I did enjoy it. It brightened my. I think it was this morning I read it before I went to work,
fantastic.
And it brightened up my morning. It really did.
I was quite proud of myself because I wanted to sort of reference the 80s in a bit of a different way with some insider jokes. So I set it out quite blatantly at the start, which I thought was fun to just say, this is 1985. and then put in random references to the old Acorn Electron computer.
Yeah, I saw that one.
and I don't know whether you also picked up on that little line of dialogue in that balloon. Where the character of Nelly says, how's about I chew on the wires of your Acorn Electron? Or something like that.
Yeah,
That's my reference to War Games, where the general says, are we allowed to use bad language on this?
Yes, you can.
Where the general says, hell, I'd piss on the spark plugs if I thought it would help.
Yeah.
So that's my little Easter eggs there.
Oh, it's great. It made me giggle, actually. It really made me giggle the way that she actually said the whole name of the computer. Yeah. Your ankle. Yeah, it's like in 1985. You know?
it's just those sort of silly things
really make me laugh, you know?
Yeah.
It's daft,
isn't it? That's the kind of thing I like to put in there, little gags. There's a character that gets referenced that there's going to be a main character called Fred Danson, which obviously...
We all know where that's come from.
Yeah. So I just thought that was funny. The same way as in Goons of the Galaxy, I have a character called Cliff Richard, but spelt with a K. As long as I'm laughing.
Somebody somewhere else is always laughing, honestly.
There you go. Yeah.
But yeah. So it sounds like you've got your sort of future plans all laid out. Obviously you can't do the school stuff at the moment, I presume, and the library stuff because of COVID, which is a real shame. But do you plan to carry on with that in the future once you're able to again?
Oh, definitely. I've managed to do a couple of little in-person drawing clubs in a place here in Macclesfield. It's like a big food hall, but they have a big outside space.
Right.
And I've started doing after-school clubs there at the start of the year. And so I managed to do two Saturday morning, very socially distanced. We planned it out, worked it out. a lot less children. So like just 12 children, three to a table. So it was but it was a chance to engage publicly. And I've been doing a lot of things online. I did a YouTube show and Zoom parties over the lockdown. But nothing beats kind of being there in person.
No.
So hopefully next year when things can calm down, I can start doing that. And my wife and I, if things hadn't gone wrong this year, in May this year, we were opening a little studio space where we were going to work from, and I was going to have a place to sell my comics from, and also comics that we were kind of selecting to get in front of the good people of Macclesfield. And I was also going to be using it as a workshop space to run workshops from there. So at some point, hopefully early next year, that will still happen.
Definitely, mate. I mean, this thing isn't going to go on forever. You know, at some point your plans are going to go back onto the rails again, aren't they?
We'll get there. We'll get there.
Definitely. And we'll certainly have you back at Comic Salopia when we restart. I mean, with the feedback we got from the workshops that you did for us. Unfortunately, the shop, you know, the Buttonham shop, it's closed.
Oh, I know.
So sad to hear about that.
They were the nicest family. They were so kind to me and my family. We kind of set up camp in their shop.
So
me and Sarah McIntyre were doing alternate workshops.
That's right,
And I set up a little corner in the shop to try and sell some of my stuff and did do, which was great. But they looked after us and made me coffees and just let us, and we went for pizza with them and stuff like that.
It's a wonderful place.
They were a lovely family, and I like to think that maybe they'll be back.
It would be wonderful. I mean, I was so upset when I heard it had closed, because it was a wonderful place for kids to go and get books.
Yeah.
You know,
the
whole environment. You know, it was so beautifully decorated, and the little works and the workshop space, and you know, on the floor below that you worked in. I mean, there's nothing else like that. Not just in Shrewsbury, but anywhere. You know,
it's funny because the way they had it there, you know, space to do workshops, selling books that particularly, I mean, they had a big range of books, but they had a really great eye for things that you'd not seen anywhere else.
Yeah.
And that is definitely how we were going to approach, or how we are going to approach our space.
All right. So it's a little bit of an inspiration. So there's a saving grace there, that the definitely. Influence from the Button and Bear is going to carry on over to the work that you guys are going to do in Macclesfield, hopefully.
Yeah. So they're there in spirit. And maybe they'll come to Macclesfield and visit as well. That'd be really cool.
Oh, that'd be great, wouldn't it? Yeah. It's nice to know that, you know, something of the idea will still exist somewhere. You know,
definitely.
It's a great place. Fantastic. Well, Mark, we've had well over our hour. It's gone really quick. It's been a great chat. We've really had a good little chin wag.
I really enjoyed that. Thank you very much, Shane.
Oh, you're welcome, mate. Thank you for coming on. And, you know, hopefully we'll get you on again in the future when you're doing different work and things have changed, and we'll have you back and we'll have another conversation, because I really enjoyed that.
Fantastic. So,
have yourself a great evening, mate, and we'll do this again soon. All the best to you.
You too. Take care. Stay well.
And you. Bye-bye.